this is Derek Frost from the Triangle Radio Reading Service. For the next hour, I'll be reading to you from the Triangle Business Journal. The content of this program is intended for a print and visually impaired audience. And we start on the front page of the Triangle Business Journal with the headline across the top of the page, Why IBM's Headcount Matters to the Region. And this article is written by Lauren K. Onsorge with a dateline of Morrisville. Data out of the union seeking to represent IBM indicates layoffs have taken their toll on Big Blue's Research Triangle Park operations, but IBM isn't talking. According to Alliance at IBM, internal IBM documents show 7,470 regular employees and 265 executives were left at its RTP campus at the end of 2012, numbers that don't include a round of layoffs from earlier this year. Compare those figures to the 10,000 headcount released in 2008. While IBM may still be the largest employer in RTP, it's a big shift for the computer services company. But these numbers aren't news, says union spokesperson Lee Conrad. Every time the media used an old number from IBM, I would correct it, he says. As IBM has a policy against releasing or confirming a headcount number, there's no way to know how accurate Conrad's estimations are, so media outlets continue to use that safe 10,000 figure to the ire of Conrad. Spokesperson Doug Shelton did release this statement in response to a request for comment, similar to so many statements he's released in the past. IBM does not publicly disclose employee headcount of our IBM locations for competitive reasons. He adds that IBM's RTP campus represents one of the world's largest investments in information technology. He points to the 802 patents IBM workers were credited with last year and adds that the RTP location is vital to nearly every facet of business at IBM. From chip design, RFID tracking, software, gaming, servers, and managing the IT infrastructure for some of the world's largest companies, it's all there, he says. But as to how much is still there in headcount, he won't say. The secrecy doesn't lessen the significance of those numbers, not just to Big Blue, but to the entire region, says North Carolina State University economist Michael Walden. They are very important, he says of IBM. But they, and the tech sector, are undergoing changes. The economy never stands still. Companies and jobs are constantly coming and going, even in the best of times. And he looks on the bright side. The important thing is that the triangle has the elements for a growing and attractive economy. College grads, competitive cost of living, accessibility, natural amenities, plus we have a growing innovative sector, which experts think is the key for successfully addressing challenges that always come. IBM, longtime anchor tenant and symbol of RTP innovation, still nets top headlines every time a layoff rumor crosses the wire. Specifically, it's about the multiplier, says Carlotta Ungaro, president of the Morrisville Chamber of Commerce. Direct impact is what the wages are, and the indirect impact is usually a multiplier of between 2.5 to 3, and that's how she visualizes the economic impact of a specific employer. According to industry site Glassdoor.com, those RTP jobs at IBM can pay in six figures, implying that the losses would add up. We hate to see these types of jobs on the decrease in the area because these jobs create the service jobs, the restaurant jobs, the dry cleaner, the car sales, the retail, home buying, all of those things, she says. Jim Verdonik, a Ward and Smith attorney, put IBM's reasoning for not disclosing a headcount into perspective. If different locations at IBM specialize in different products and services, one reason not to announce employee count by location is that competitors could gain insight into what part of IBM's business is growing and what part is shrinking, he says. There's a third possible factor. Maybe someone at IBM doesn't like talking to the press or is afraid they will be blamed if a negative article comes out, he says. No one gets fired for not talking to a reporter. And now we move down the front page of the Triangle Business Journal to this issue's cover story. The cover story is titled, Triangle's Little India, a richly diverse tapestry is being woven in Morrisville. And this article is written by Dawn Curry with the dateline of Morrisville. Four Indian Americans ran for elected office in Morrisville in the November 5th election, including a bid for the mayor's post. Although three of them lost, the incumbent was able to hold on to his slot as a councilman. That four Indian Americans were on the ballot in a small North Carolina town of merely 8.26 square miles made headlines in the Indian American community across the U.S., and the foreign Indian press even picked up the story. During the past decade, the fabric of multiculturalism has become more deeply woven with the dramatic change in the population base of Mooresville, a town that for years was more of a central business district that played second fiddle to its neighboring towns, Cary and Apex. According to the latest census data, almost 20% of Mooresville's current population of 22,671 is of Indian origin, compared to only 4% in 2000. The Triangle has seen growth as well, albeit not as dramatic. Raleigh's Indian population grew from 0.9% in 2000 to 1% in 2010. Cary's Indian population grew from 3% in 2000 to 6% in 2010. Census records show that there are twice as many Indians in the Triangle as there are in the Charlotte-Mecklenburg area. So how did this convergence in Mooresville happen so fast? Jobs and amenities. Few people, both Indian Americans and those not of Indian origin, dispute that a primary reason is the proximity to Research Triangle Park, which plays host to multinational companies such as IBM, Cisco Systems, NetApp, and GlaxoSmithKline. Jobs opened up, people were transferred to the Raleigh area, and Mooresville became a convenient, quiet, and attractive place to live. In addition, Indian students graduating from area universities such as NC State University have accepted engineering and technology jobs near RTP, bought houses nearby, and settled down. Visitors walking through the main streets of Mooresville and the retail centers of this growing town may catch a whiff of the spices being sold at the nearby shops. As the Indian population has grown, specialty grocery stores have sprung up, stocking such ingredients as rices for biryani dishes, a variety of grains, curry powders, pickles, chutneys, and vegetables that aren't commonly found in American supermarkets. The Galaxy Cinema shows Bollywood movies, and cricket matches are held on the weekends. Chris Vishwanathan, owner of Paradise Indian Cuisine and Aloha Mind Math Tutoring Center in Mooresville, said he attributes much of Mooresville's population growth, aside from the cultural amenities that have popped up, to Indian families relocating from Cary. Mooresville is closer to RTP, has good schools, and is known for low crime, says his friends. When Indians go, other Indians often follow, bringing with them their complex culture and beliefs. Whether North or South Indian, Mooresville now has temples, cafes, grocery stores like Patel Brothers, and boutiques that carry Indian-made imported cosmetics, clothes, and household goods. A sense of community. But one can sense things are changing in Mooresville. While the traditional career paths of engineering and medicine are still very high on the list, Indian Americans living in this Little India township are getting involved in marketing, real estate, student governments, and running for office. Vinny Goel, a North Indian who lives in Mooresville, is a good example. He says he ran for city council to represent small business owners, not just Indians. He owns Goel's Plaza on International Drive, a banquet and entertainment facility with rental space for weddings, performances, and social events. He also owns A1 Consulting, an engineering firm. One of his priorities is to address the numerous regulations that impact and hinder small businesses. I've seen both sides of the fence, said Goel, who not only owns two businesses but also served on several municipal boards, including the Planning and Zoning Board. Let's create a more friendly partnership environment between government and the private sector. Although he lost his council bid, he intends to remain active in advocating for balance between the priorities of small business and government. A shift in focus. Indians in the Triangle who came from India to the United States originally focused on economic stability and maintaining strong traditions, including hard work and high standards in the pursuit of technology, engineering, and medicine fields. However, many Indian Americans, children born here of parents who came from India, seem to be heading in more diverse directions. Recently re-elected Mooresville Town Councilman Steve Rao, an Indian American, says he sees the younger generation of Indian Americans shifting away from IT jobs toward public service jobs, Indian American kids have grown up in American culture and insist on being whatever they want to be, says Rao. In the next generation, those kids who are 19 and 20 now, what I'm seeing is that they want to go into public service, said Rao. I've got kids asking me how they get these jobs. And Indian American children are hardly just playing cricket. Vishwanathan said his daughter is a driven tennis player and involved in Key Club. And store owner Satish Deva said his cousin's son is a dedicated Boy Scout. Rao said young Indian Americans are more involved in fundraisers and charitable organizations and are more conscious of things going on in the world. According to Hari Nath, a North Indian who moved to the United States in 1969 and to Kerry in 1980, this is a dynamic cultural shift. In the past, Indians were more likely to consider community service once their families were economically stable. But today, many Indian Americans are community conscious from a very young age. Assimilation challenges. Despite these changes, Nath says there are still a number of Indians who prefer to congregate together rather than mingle with the non-Indian culture surrounding them. I find some of the newer generation is living in a cocoon, he says. With Indian TV and temples and restaurants, they don't attempt to mix with the society at large. South Indian cousins Satish Deva and Gwagul Tippareni have been running Apna Bazaar, an Indian grocery store in Morrisville, for 5 years and cater mostly to Indian shoppers. They said from time to time, curious non-Indians come in and ask for something specific, but they estimate only about 10% of their customers are non-Indian. While the Indian business climate seems to be rapidly expanding, some business owners have been slow to integrate into the greater business community. We don't have a huge number of Indian business owners as Morrisville Chamber members, says Morrisville Chamber of Commerce President Carlotta Ungaro. Economic potential. Nath, founder and CEO of Technology Planning and Management Corporation, serves as a volunteer Indian community liaison to the governor's office. He is also a member of the Board of Governors for the University of North Carolina system and has served on the Town of Cary's Planning and Zoning Board, the Board of Adjustments, and the Economic Development Commission. He launched the Indus Entrepreneurs, TIE, Carolinas chapter, part of a nonprofit networking organization that supports global entrepreneurs with programs and educational events. India could play a significant role in North Carolina's economic future. Recognizing the potential for a strong business connection, Governor Pat McCrory is considering a trip to India to strengthen the bond. While Nath says the growing relationship is of economic value, he says North Carolina's leaders should not be hasty. My recommendation to him has been not to go to India unless some agreements have been made, such as companies coming into North Carolina to open office here, said Nath. Otherwise, the trip will not be of great value and he will be criticized. Rao is optimistic about the potential for economic leverage from U.S.-India relations. We've created this environment that allows us to have global alliances, says Rao. Those areas that embrace it are the regions that thrive. And now we turn to the biz section, a quick glance at Triangle happenings. The headline that starts it off, coffee that Goldilocks would love. A pair of entrepreneurs in Wake Forest want to change the way you drink your morning cup of coffee, and they think you'll pay upwards of $40 to keep your coffee cozy. Dean Verhoeven and Logan Maxwell are betting big on a Kickstarter campaign to launch the Temperfect mug. Under the pitch line, never burn your mouth again. About 24 hours in, and the pair had already raised nearly $4,000 of their $23,500 goal. The cash will go toward a dual manufacturing operation overseas and in nearby Lewisburg. This is different from other mugs because other mugs try to keep your coffee as hot as possible for as long as possible, says Verhoeven. This mug keeps your coffee at a comfortable drinking temperature from the moment you put your coffee in there to hours later. The secret is an extra layer of insulation, which absorbs the excess energy from the coffee initially and stores it and releases it. Verhoeven says he has been working on the idea since 1995, and Maxwell had worked on a similar idea as his senior design project at North Carolina State University. Fred's and colleagues bid farewell to Cook. It was a raucous evening at the Oxford in downtown Raleigh on November 22 when business and community leaders came together to send off Wake County Manager David Cook in style. Cook is retiring after 17 years on the job. Filled with laughter and mocking chants of "fire him," Cook soaked in the attention before speaking to the audience made up of some of his closest friends, such as Alfred Williams, John McKinney, and Catherine Thomas, Wake County Commissioner Joe Bryan, and soon-to-be opponent Sig Hutchison, and Parker Poe attorney Melanie Dubis. Users pick 10 best Triangle restaurants. Just in time for the holidays, here are Triangle Area's top 10 restaurants based on more than 200,000 user reviews at OpenTable.com, a website that offers restaurant reservation service in real time. Raleigh claims 4 spots on the list, with establishments in Cary, Pittsboro, Tarboro, and Kinston also making appearances. And here's the list starting from number 1 through 10. Second Empire Restaurant in Raleigh, Farrington House, Pittsboro, St. Jock's, Raleigh, Bita Manda Restaurant, Raleigh, Chef and the Farmer, Kinston, Ruth's Chris, Durham, On the Square, Tarboro, Ray's in Cary, Ruth's Chris, Raleigh, and Heron's in Cary. From Family Soda Fountain to Bank. SunTrust Bank recently celebrated the relocation of its downtown branch to the historic building at 200 North Mangum Street in Durham. The location holds a special connection for Bill Rogers, SunTrust's chairman and CEO. His grandfather, Will Rogers, was one of the co-founders of Rogers Drug Company, which occupied the same location for over 50 years. For more than 5 decades, Rogers Drug served as a downtown Durham meeting spot where people would gather to discuss the day's events, enjoy a root beer float, and pick up their prescriptions. Vet sees opportunity with North Hills Clinic. Raleigh veterinarian Laura Evans is planning to open a new pet resort and animal clinic in an established North Raleigh neighborhood that she is hoping will catch on among both the new and the old establishment around North Hills. "Everything is sort of a risk, but I'm looking forward to it," she says. Evans, a partner at Boulevard Animal Hospital near NC State's campus, has already started construction for the new 6,000-square-foot clinic building, North Hills Animal Hospital and Resort, at the corner of Six Forks Road and Shelley Road. Evan says the idea for the wide portico at the front of the building is to allow pet owners to drop off their pets with a valet at the door for day camp or boarding services and then head on to work. The building will also have a second floor for cat condos. "A lot of clinics have been going where the sprawl is going, but there's been a lot of infill lately in Raleigh," she says. "I think it's ripe for needing this kind of service." Contributing to Biz were staffers Amanda Jones-Hoyle, Jesse Burkhart, and Lauren Onsorge. And now we turn to a section in the Triangle Business Journal titled Executive Voice, an interview with Steve Ayala. The headline on the article, "He Can't Imagine Doing Anything Else for a Living." And this is written by Lauren K. Onsorge. For Steve Ayala, president and co-founder of Raleigh-based financial software firm Clinverse, the possibilities are stacking up. His company's finance management technology is paying more than 1,400 clinical trial sites in more than 40 countries, and that's about to increase to 6,000 sites in 75 countries. Clinverse started in Charlotte and moved to Raleigh in 2010 with 12 employees. Currently, it employs 45. The anticipated growth will mean more than 20 new team additions in the near future, Ayala says. "We have built this technology to automate the financial management of clinical trials, and so what we do largely is automate the financial transactions between drug companies and doctors and contract research organizations. It's likely more complex than what goes on in your average human resource office, or would be, without software such as Clinverse's flagship ClinPay. If a drug company needs 500 patients in a clinical trial, they may have to go out and recruit 100 different doctors and negotiate contracts with those different doctors to get patients in a clinical trial," he says. As a drug company, if you have 100 doctors and 100 negotiated contracts, well, without our system, the calculation and tracking of how those doctors get paid would all be done manually. Imagine working through that Excel spreadsheet. But that's Clinverse's business model. For Ayala's, we asked the man himself. How would you describe your management style? My philosophy is to identify the very best people that know a lot more than I do and get out of their way. We have added significantly to our executive ranks this year and have some extremely talented people to lead our organization to the next level. What's your pet peeve in the office? I'm pretty easygoing. Not much bothers me. What's your secret to maintaining work-home-life balance? I'm pretty confident that I have not successfully maintained this balance. It is a challenge, but at the end of the day, family is most important to me. Did you have a mentor? I have been fortunate to have worked for and exposed to some great leaders throughout my career. I am always observing and learning how I can be better, both personally and professionally. When someone comes in for a job interview at Clinverse, what should they not do? Be unprepared. What are your hobbies? With a wife and two young daughters, any free time I have, I choose to spend with family. I also enjoy sports and spending time with close friends. What's your favorite vacation spot? St. John, U.S. Virgin Islands, a beautiful and peaceful spot. If you weren't in healthcare or IT, what would your dream job be? I'm having too much fun growing this business to contemplate anything else. It has been a fun ride so far. And now in the Triangle Business Journal, we'll turn to the A Better World section, news about people and groups in the Triangle making a difference with their giving and philanthropic activities. First, we start with Todd Cohen's column. The headline on his column, Enloe students devote time and talents to help fight child abuse. The first week in December, at assemblies for all 2,700 students, student council leaders at Enloe High School in Raleigh will talk about child abuse and how students can help fight it. The assemblies are part of a council project to raise awareness about the issue and to raise $50,000 to support Safe Child, a child abuse prevention agency. The effort, which is led entirely by students and will culminate in the 9th annual Enloe Charity Ball at Marble's Kids Museum on December 14, is highly unusual, both in the amount of money to be raised and in the fact that the funds will benefit a charity, not the student's own school. I am not aware of another student group at an individual school that is trying to raise these kinds of dollars for the community, says Nancy Bromhall, Development Director at Safe Child. The effort includes a 3-week competition among homerooms that last year raised more than $8,000, a campaign to secure sponsorships and in-kind donations from businesses, a social media campaign, and the sale of tickets and non-alcoholic drinks at the event, which is expected to attract 1,000 students, says Trudy Pierce O'Neill, an English teacher at Enloe, who advises the council. Last year's event netted $51,000 and benefited Interact of Way County, a nonprofit that serves victims and survivors of domestic violence, rape, and sexual assault. People told me there was no way we would do it, Prince O'Neill says. My reward was giving that check to Interact. Planning for this year's ball began last spring when the newly elected council president and 4 vice presidents identified possible charities to support, met during the summer to narrow the list, and visited the 4 finalists before selecting Safe Child. Separate committees of the council, which consists of 70 students, handle tasks for the ball focusing on food, publicity, decorations, coat checking, tickets, and registration and logistics. The council also held a weekend retreat in October, right after a briefing about Safe Child from some of its staff. Council committees at the retreat made assignments for the ball, and its officers trained all members to ask for sponsorship and donations. You have to put yourself out there and ask, says Clara Femia, an Enloe senior who chairs the ball as the council's vice president of service. It's hard, especially the first time, to ask for a donation because asking for money is a difficult thing to do. You just have to do it. A big factor in selecting Safe Child was the warm welcome from its staff, Femia says. It was so obvious how much they wanted our help and appreciated being considered. But the determining factor was the agency's focus, she says. There are abused kids at Enloe who could benefit from Safe Child, she says. We knew that giving money to Safe Child would help kids our age who are being abused. We also knew that for kids who are suffering silently, if we raised money for this charity, it would inevitably raise awareness. And in the nonprofit news section, the Remodelers Council of the Home Builders Association of Raleigh-Wake County are renovating the Wake Interfaith Hospitality Network, WIHN, facility at 903 Method Road in Raleigh. WIHN responds to the needs of homeless families in Wake County with a specific goal of finding temporary stability to homes, families as they work towards permanent independence. More than 200 children call the WIHN facility home every year. The WIHN's facility was in dire need of restoration, especially on the ground floor where flooding and ruptured septic pump accidents have caused major damage. Attention Triangle nonprofit leaders, Milner Incorporated wants to give you $35,000. The technology company kicked off a Technology Jumpstart Your Nonprofit contest and will give away tech upgrades or office supplies to nonprofits who garner the most votes. Two winning nonprofit organizations will receive an office equipment makeover with a combined total value up to $35,000. The makeover may include, but is not limited to, a black and white and or color multifunction printer, telephony equipment, IT consulting services, ongoing networking support, and other technologies to make offices run more efficiently. Milner completed a jumpstart program in the Metro Atlanta area earlier this year. The overwhelming response resulted in 109 organizations being nominated and over 80,000 online votes being cast. The contest is open to verifiable 501c3 nonprofit groups with physical office locations in the Triangle's 7-county region. Visit www.milner.com/jumpstart for contest details. And now we return to the reporter pages in the Triangle Business Journal. The first one is for reporter Amanda Hoyle. Hoyle covers commercial and residential real estate. The headline on her article, Publix chooses Falls of New site. A Charlotte developer with close ties to the Publix grocery store chain has taken the first step toward rezoning land at the heavily trafficked entrance into the Bedford at Falls River community for a new neighborhood shopping center. The 6-acre site at the Falls of Neuse intersection with Dunn Road had originally been intended for commercial office buildings when the 1,141-acre community master plan was approved in 1994. But so far, only a daycare center has opened at the site. While many of the Falls River neighbors are excited that Publix, a Florida-based grocery group, might open its first Raleigh store near their community, others are also concerned that the grocery store would increase traffic to the site. The city is currently in the final stages of a $12 million realignment and widening project of Falls of Neuse Road leading into Falls River. The project, as proposed by Charlotte development firm Morgan Property Group, would include a food store, a bank, and a building for smaller retail businesses. Publix will be opening its first store in the Triangle in late 2014 at the new Bradford Shopping Center in Cary, but the company hasn't yet announced deals for any other locations here. The Raleigh Planning Commission on November 26 approved a request to remove from the Falls River Master Plan the 6-acre site that Morgan Property Group wants to develop for Publix. This step is required before the developers can request a rezoning of the site. And now we turn to the page for reporter Jason DeBrun. DeBrun covers healthcare, higher education, and nonprofits. The headline on his main article, Wall Street is helping UNC Health's finances. Lower than expected discharges from the hospital contributed to a first quarter in which UNC Healthcare did not meet its budgeted financial targets. Net operating revenue came in about $23.8 million lower than budgeted, but expenses were only about $10.3 million less than expected, leading to operating income of $2.3 million or $13.6 million less than budgeted. An operating profit of $2.3 million doesn't sound bad, but the administration has already said that the second half of the year will likely show worse figures than the first half as it rolls out its electronic health record system called Epic at UNC. For the year, UNC Healthcare, which includes hospitals like Rex Healthcare and Chatham Hospital, and the UNC Faculty Physicians and UNC Physicians Network, projects total operating revenue of $2.5 billion and an operating loss of 0.3%, or $7.5 million. Although operations missed targets, non-operating incomes have significantly outperformed the projected amounts. For the first quarter, UNC Healthcare recorded $22 million from interest and investment income, partly as the stock market as a whole has been setting record highs recently. Taken together, the hospital posted a net income of $22.7 million, or slightly below the budgeted $25.7 million. And in another section, it's headlined, "Most U.S. Patients Think Health System is Broken." And there's a number of percentages with explanations. 37%. In 2013, more than one-third, 37%, of U.S. adults went without recommended care, did not see a doctor when they were sick, or failed to fill prescriptions because of costs, compared with as few as 4% to 6% in the United Kingdom and Sweden. 40%. Roughly 40% of both insured and uninsured U.S. respondents spent $1,000 or more out of pocket during the year on medical care, not counting premiums. High deductibles and cost sharing, along with no limits on out-of-pocket costs, may explain why even insured people in the U.S. struggled to afford needed health care, the researcher said. 23%. Nearly one quarter, 23%, of U.S. adults either had serious problems paying medical bills or were unable to pay them, compared with fewer than 13% of adults in the next highest country, France, and 6% or fewer in the U.K., Sweden, and Norway. 32%. About one-third, 32% of U.S. adults spent a lot of time dealing with insurance paperwork and disputes, or were either denied payment for a claim or paid less than expected. Only 25% of adults in Switzerland, 19% in the Netherlands, and 17% in Germany, all countries with competitive health insurance markets, reported these problems. 75%. The vast majority, 75%, of U.S. adults said their health system needs to undergo fundamental changes or be rebuilt completely. The U.S. spends $8,508 per person on health care. That is nearly $3,000 more per person than Norway, the second highest spender. And in the last section on this reporter page, a section titled Big Numbers, the number is $7.56 million. The amount John Placeka will receive when Posen makes a one-time cash payment to shareholders. Posen, a publicly traded pharmaceutical development company in Chapel Hill, will pay $1.75 per share to all stockholders as of close of business on December 11th. Placeka, the CEO who owns 14% of the company, will receive $7.56 million. Posen's other big investors include PAR Investment Partners from Boston, which will receive $4.1 million, the Vanguard Group from Malvern, Pennsylvania, which will receive $2.8 million, and BlackRock Incorporated from New York, which will receive $2.7 million. And now we turn to the reporter page for Lauren Onsorge. Onsorge covers infotech, biotechnology, and entrepreneurism. The title on her main article, Drinking with the Stars for Profit. New York City-based Bobble, dubbed the sexy and sustainable water filtration company by co-founder Stephanie Watson, is coming to Raleigh and is bringing the attention of an A-list fan club of celebrities such as actors Kristen Bell, Sophia Bush, and Ian Somerhalder. Watson tells me the celebrity buzz her signature product, a colorful filter-topped water bottle, has created is what has pushed Bobble from idea to a profitable business. The business started about 4 years ago, smack in the middle of the financial crisis. We were looking stuff within the range of low-hanging fruit, easy to get out on the market, she says initially. She had wanted to start a travel goods company, but the financial crisis meant fewer travelers. People kept drinking water, though, so Watson made it her mission to mesh her design background with problem-solving skills and compete with single-serve water bottles. We were all just thinking that buying water bottles is a stupid thing to do, she says. Why wouldn't you just reuse? She focused on that eye-popping color on the filters and created something that was as stylish as it was functional. Creating that style was the first step. It became a sustainable badge, one that identified a consumer as eco-minded, and celebrities wanted to be seen with that badge. It helped that her company shipped bottles to a myriad of events, from a volleyball tournament to Australia to a talk show in Japan. And eventually, events started calling Bauble, and Bauble's sales revenue came quickly. The growth skyrocketed when celebrities started using the bottles in front of paparazzi. Sophia Bush, a familiar face in Wilmington, as the star of its One Tree Hill, even had Bauble develop her own signature bottle. And the fame is still coming, as Bauble was recently the bottle of choice on the set of Fox hit series Glee. Watson and her team capitalize on celebrity buzz, posting every photo of a celebrity holding a Bauble they could find on their Facebook page, from a shot of Ben Affleck and Jennifer Garner to Kristen Bell. I think social media is the most amazing tool for a startup, she says. For startups, this is a great age to be in because we have this tool. It served us really, really well. And the growth attracted the attention of Seventh Generation's new venture arm, which acquired Bauble earlier this year. While Watson will continue to be based in New York, Bauble is forming a new Raleigh team to be headquartered at HQ Raleigh alongside its parent company. In addition to John Riplogle, former CEO of Burt's Bees and current CEO of Seventh Generation, three full-time Baublers will be stationed in Raleigh. But Seventh Generation's corporate team in Burlington, Vermont also provides support. We're about being a sexy, sustainable brand, bringing in some personality, she says. We were lucky enough to find a brand like Seventh Generation that is honestly sustainable. Financial terms for the deal were not disclosed. And in another section named By the Numbers, SaaS numbers show Wake's global connections. SaaS has put on its Mapmaker hat, releasing new numbers on North Carolina's international connections. The Carry software firm, fronted by billionaire CEO James Goodnight, has launched a free online resource called Mapping the Nation, Linking Local to Global. Here's a By the Numbers breakdown for Wake County. 12.78, the percent total population that's foreign-born. 69,599,829, the estimated economic contributions of international students and dependents. 3,605,720,109, the estimated sales value of imports and exports of goods. 132,674, the number of people who speak languages at home other than English. 7,030, the total number of students enrolled in post-secondary language education. And in a section titled New to the Market, the headline, From Gaming Guru to Restaurateur. Video game celebrity Cliff Bleszinski's latest project is a lot more edible than Gears of War. Station Raleigh, a restaurant, not a video game, is officially open on Person Street. Announced via Twitter by Bleszinski, better known as Cliffy B, he calls the venture a cozy, rustic watering hole. Bleszinski, a former designer at Cary-based Epic Games, started the restaurant with Niall Hanley, owner of Hibernian Pub, according to a tweet. He's also asking his 213,500-plus followers to come say hi. As a sort of retired guy who just opened a restaurant, I think a car dealership is next, he tweets. For the record, he says he's kidding about that. And final section, titled He Said It, the headline, Whitehurst Goodnight Speak Out. Red Hat CEO Jim Whitehurst and SaaS CEO Jim Goodnight spoke at a panel on the skills gap and had a lot to say. We have enough kids enrolling in STEM, but about 60% of them drop out, Goodnight says, of universities. They move out of STEM because it's just too tough. If we could just cut that drop rate from 60 down to 45%, we would have enough STEM graduates. We are in a talent race against other countries, Whitehurst says. As an American, I want to make sure we're competitive. I would prefer that we reduce some of the programs that are providing funds for people not working, Goodnight says. There's an awful lot of that going on. I would rather spend money educating people rather than continuously feeding them. And now we turn to the People Spotlight in the Triangle Business Journal. And the spotlight is on Stephanie McLean, Director of Regional Community Development at Goodwill Community Foundation. The former executive director of an Eastern North Carolina chapter of the Boys and Girls Clubs, Stephanie McLean, has now been tapped to spread the mission of the Goodwill Community Foundation through partnerships all along Eastern North Carolina. As Director of Regional Community Development at Goodwill Community Foundation, McLean is responsible for coordinating the use of GCF's resources by identifying and developing relationships with community-based organizations in eastern North Carolina, mostly east of the I-95 corridor. In 2013, GCF says that its grant distributions will approach $1.8 million to 11 organizations. It is essential that GCF understand the needs and problems in eastern North Carolina through partnerships with community-based organizations, said GCF President Dennis McLean in a statement. It is equally important for GCF to identify those entities that are effectively meeting the needs of their community. Stephanie will be the GCF staff member working with organizations. We have a responsibility to ensure that those receiving GCF funds are using them in a manner that aligns with our mission to create opportunities for a better life in North Carolina, the U.S., and abroad. GCF seeks out Eastern North Carolina-based nonprofits with compatible missions to provide free financial support through grants. According to the organization, it has given more than $6.2 million to regional organizations focused on youth and persons with disabilities over the past 18 years. GCF also supports Goodwill Industries of Eastern North Carolina through approximately $25 million in grants in 2013 that fund employment opportunities, free educational resources, food donations, and services to people with disabilities and their families. These grants also work to help fund free financial services for nonprofit organizations across the region. GCF's stated mission is to create and provide education, employment, and life enrichment opportunities for people who desire to improve the quality of their lives. Background: McLean comes to GCF from Boys and Girls Club of Edenton, Chowan County, where she was the executive director for more than 2 years. She has experience in community development and leadership, as well as an intimate understanding of the day-to-day challenges associated with directing a small charity. Quote, the addition of McLean to this position is the next step in fully implementing the GCF strategy of reaching out to lift the quality of life of people regionally, nationally, and internationally, Dennis McLean said in a statement. And now we'll turn to the Viewpoint page in the Triangle Business Journal. And we'll start with the guest opinion. The guest opinion is from Andrew Broad, who is a senior research fellow in UNCG's Center for Business and Economic Research. And the headline on his guest column, Many Motives for Moving to North Carolina. North Carolina Commerce Secretary Sharon Decker said recently that one of the reasons unemployment in the state remains stubbornly high is that unemployed people are moving here. A headline characterized that as a claim that North Carolina is attracting unemployed people. That's not quite what Decker said, but it's close. Empirical economic research reveals little evidence that people move for better unemployment benefits. Better benefits can discourage the unemployed from moving away, but that's a different issue. Overall, Americans move significantly less than they used to. According to Census Bureau data, the rate of moving has fallen nearly by half since the mid-1980s to just 12% in 2012. The rate hit an all-time low of 11.6% in 2011. So much for hard times forcing people to hit the road. When the recession got bad in North Carolina a few years ago, we didn't suddenly see people moving to low unemployment states like North Dakota or Nebraska. Two-thirds of all moves are within the same county, and about a fifth are within the same state. Only about 14% of all moves are from state to state. Since the late 1990s, the Census Bureau has asked movers why they moved. One must be careful with the data, because job-related moves include such motivations as wanting a shorter commute. New job or job transfer has consistently accounted for about a tenth of all moves. Only about 2% of movers say they moved to look for work or because they lost a job, though that figure rose as high as 2.7% early in the last recession. These data apply to all categories of moves, though moving to look for work is most likely to be an interstate move. The biggest reason for moving appears to be housing, and the number of movers looking for cheaper housing or dealing with evictions and foreclosures rose during the last recession. Is it possible that some of the people coming to North Carolina are here to look for work? Sure. But that's not a bad thing. After all, new residents are not just suppliers of labor, i.e. workers. They're also demanders of labor through their purchases. If more people buy groceries, then more people are needed to stock the shelves and so on. Unemployment here has fallen in approximate lockstep with the rest of the U.S. People moving in are not slowing down North Carolina's recovery. And next we have the editor's notebook. The headline, while Texas and Louisiana stole the show, the Triangle did just fine. And this is written by Sugata Mukherjee, editor of Triangle Business Journal. In the age of global competitiveness, a list of the top markets in the South that bag the largest economic development projects reflects momentum and, frankly, the power of the community's brand. Southern Business and Development Magazine's latest issue talks about the Federal Reserve report titled The Big Busy, that chronicles the economic transformation of New Orleans after Hurricane Katrina catastrophe in 2005. Nested in that story on the Fed's report was a list of the top areas for the largest 100 projects each year between 2003 and 2012. New Orleans was first with 55 projects, rich with jobs and capital investments. Baton Rouge, Louisiana came in second with 54 projects. As for the Triangle, Durham and Raleigh were tied for the 15th slot with 7 projects each in the past decade. We really should total that number since the entire Triangle benefits when projects land in a particular city or town. So let's say our number is 14. That would put us tied for 8th with Austin, Texas and Decatur, Alabama, according to the Economic Development Magazine. Other than New Orleans and Baton Rouge, the other cities ahead of Raleigh-Durham include Houston, Dallas, Lake Charles, Louisiana, San Antonio, and Memphis, Tennessee. Notice the pattern? Other than Memphis, which is a distribution capital of the East Coast, every other locale is tied to liquid gold, oil, and through that energy extension, let's add natural gas to the mix as well. The transformation of New Orleans is a story for the ages. More than $110 billion in federal aid poured into the Big Easy. That spiked wages by 19% between 2004 and 2012. The national average wage hike during that time? 1%. One could argue Texas and Louisiana may not be aware of the Great Recession, but the Triangle does. And these impressive grab of the big projects suggest our brand did just fine, especially when it comes to the Tar Heel State being in play to land big projects with big jobs at stake. And now we turn to a special section in the Triangle Business Journal called the Giving Guide. And the main article in this section has the headline, Triangle Giving Finally on the Rise Again. And this article is written by Jason DeBrun. Although philanthropy from individuals and private companies in the Triangle is slowly rebounding, it's not making up for the losses from governments and has still not rebounded to pre-recession levels. Private philanthropy is coming back, says Mac Kuntz, president of the United Way of the Greater Triangle. He adds a caveat, though. It's not a robust recovery and being offset with government reductions. Overall giving declined by some 10% in 2009 and 2010, which Kuntz says is the sharpest decline he had ever seen in his career, which includes time with other nonprofits like Big Brothers and Big Sisters of America. Still, he and other nonprofit leaders don't want to complain about the effects of the recession anymore. I think we all want to look forward now, he says. Compared to other metros, people in the Triangle aren't as generous as elsewhere in the country. Durham and Chapel Hill rank 129th, and Raleigh ranks 133 in the nation in median giving, according to the Chronicle of Philanthropy. The Chronicle compared tax return data for itemized tax returns in 2008 and ranked America's 366 major metropolitan areas. More recent data doesn't exist because of the time needed to collect and compare tax returns. The median contribution in this area was right around $3,000, or about 5%, of the median discretionary income of $59,000. In Charlotte, the median contribution was $3,162, or 5.8% of median discretionary income, ranking it 86th among cities. Provo, Utah ranked number one, with a median contribution of $7,059, or nearly 14% of median discretionary income. According to the North Carolina Center for Nonprofits, the nonprofit sector in North Carolina employs 425,000 workers, or about 11% of all jobs in this state. That's roughly equal to the manufacturing or retail industries. The nonprofit sector pays more than $15 billion in wages to North Carolinians. Though nonprofit organizations are tax-exempt, nonprofit employees pay taxes, state income taxes, local and state sales taxes, and property taxes. This economic impact has more than doubled in a decade. The nonprofit sector, meaning those organizations that file as 501c3, now totals more than 10,000 organizations, and its estimated $38 billion annual impact on the state's economy compares is more than double from $17 billion impact 10 years ago, according to the center. We depend on nonprofits and their significant role in making North Carolina attractive to business, Keith Crisco, former North Carolina Secretary of Commerce, has said. Many in industry and government are just learning about nonprofits' economic force. The nonprofit sector is a crucial part of our economy now and in the future. Nonprofits play an important role in helping to support those with lower incomes. Consider that North Carolina's median household income was 84% of the United States average and the second lowest among comparison states, according to an economic index report by the Commerce Department. And with our remaining time, we're turning to the 9-to-5 section in the Triangle Business Journal. Home builder H.H. Hunt Corporation, with headquarters in Cary and divisions in Raleigh, Richmond, Virginia, and Hampton Roads, Virginia, received its third consecutive Achievement Award from Trade Association Builder Partnerships. Its Raleigh Division's Award was for highest distinction in customer satisfaction. Last year, H.H. Hunt Homes was only the eighth builder nationally to have won the award of highest distinction, and it was the first home builder to have multiple divisions to do so, said H.H. Hunt Homes Vice President of Home Building, Olin Wilson, in a release. Brian Moskow, a principal in Raleigh-based Red Engineering and Design, has been selected as one of three jurors in the 2014 U.S. Woodworks Wood Design Awards, a nationwide contest. Jurors from three regions are selected based on expertise. Moskow represents the Southeast region. I am honored to be part of an awards program tradition that recognizes exceptional design and the extensive use of wood, Moskow said in a release. These projects are known for pushing the boundaries of conventional wood building practices while highlighting the versatility and beauty of wood as a building material. maybe we can borrow from the best of these ideas to use in North Carolina. Moscow has 20 years experience in the wood construction industry. The Raleigh office of Brasfield and Gorey recently received several awards from the Associated Builders and Contractors of the Carolinas. The firm was honored with the Project of the Year Award, the Carolinas Green Award, the Free Enterprise Award, and three First Place Eagle Awards. The company provides general contracting services, design, build, and construction management services for a variety of markets. And with our remaining time, we'll read as much as we can of the guest column in the Triangle Business Journal. The headline, Maintain Quality Relationships to Drive Referrals. Too often, salespeople and business owners focus on the next sale or short-term quota. Instead of asking, where's my next customer, they should ask, whom can I help today? This may seem counterintuitive at first, but developing quality relationships and helping others is actually a sound long-term strategy for generating referrals. First of all, leads and referrals are not the same thing. Leads are essentially cold calls, whereas referrals via trusted third parties are imbued with the implicit endorsement and reputation of the referring individual. You can purchase leads, but you can't purchase referrals. According to noted business author John Janch, 80% of new business for most companies comes from referrals. Referrals close business twice as often and twice as fast as leads. In the long run, devoting time to generating referrals is more productive than chasing leads. The law of reciprocity says that giving first, that is, helping others, is the best way to get others to help you. And we'll stop reading there, but the guest column was written by Craig Matthews, who is the CEO and co-founder of Tribe Spring, a Raleigh-based mobile software company. And we've run out of time for today's episode of Triangle Business Journal. Be sure to listen at the same time next week. We hope you've enjoyed it. I'm Derek Frost, reading for the Triangle Radio Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for a print and visually impaired audience. The program is readily available as a podcast after the broadcast. You can contact us at 919-832-5138. So long until next time.